Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 26th of September. Herman Cain wins the Florida straw poll, and President Barack Obama is now tough. Those were a couple of the issues that we will be discussing this hour for All Things Political with Jill Lawrence, an award-winning analyst, columnist, and commentary writer who's covered every presidential election since 1988. She is a contributor to the Daily Beast and to the Atlantic Monthly. Until recently, was a senior correspondent and columnist for PoliticsDaily.com. She's written national political columns work, reporting for USA Today and national political writer at the Associated Press. She's also written about politics for the Boston Globe, the Atlanta Constitution, the Washington Post, Humanities Magazine, and many other publications. We'll be welcoming phone calls and emails for Jill. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hi, Jill. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Happy to be here.
Yeah, great to have you. Well, let's start with some of the news over the weekend. Herman Cain wins the Florida straw poll. Was that all about Social Security that had people in Florida worrying that Rick Perry might not be the guy?
Well, I think it was more a case of cold feet about Rick Perry after his performance in the debate. That makes three debates where he just hasn't seemed to have gotten his footing. It's easy to know what to expect in the way of attacks, at least after the first debate, and he just hasn't seemed to have settled on an approach. And he also seems to get tired. People talk about his endurance. He told a Florida delegate at that event over the weekend that he was tired in the second half of the debate. So, you know, there are questions about his stamina. There are questions about his policy fluency. There are all kinds of questions about him, and I think people just decided they were going to go with their hearts, and that was Herman Cain.
And why does Herman Cain win their hearts?
Well, he is a terrific speaker. You know, he has a good story, and he was a CEO. He comes from the business world. He's got a very good oratorical style that gets everyone all excited, and he really knows how to make a case and express himself in a very passionate way. He's been winning a lot of straw polls, as have some of the other, what you might call, passion candidates, Ron Paul, Michelle Bachmann. So, you know, it wasn't a complete surprise that they turned to him. He had a good debate performance, and this is all just, I think it's a little too early for people to be seriously considering viability and electability. You could almost look at it as a protest vote.
We heard over the weekend also that there are a number of Republican higher-ups who are talking to Governor Chris Christie saying, we really want you in the race.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing that after all of the late entries who have stumbled in the past, you know, 10, 15 years, that people still think that you can get in late and it'll be a bed of roses. I think Chris Christie knows that it won't be. Just look at what happened with Rick Perry. I mean, look at Fred Thompson before him, Wes Clark before him. You know, the only person who got in late and really made a go of it was Bill Clinton, and he was a very, very practiced politician, including on the national stage. So it's, you know, it's a very tough thing to do. And Chris Christie, while everyone is now longing for the unattainable, I guess you could say, he's got a very brusque manner sometimes. You have to wonder how well he'd wear over a long period of time. You know, all those YouTube clips of him yelling at teachers and the education establishment, you know, the teachers' unions would be just totally mobilized against him, very energized. So he has his downsides, and I think he knows he's a fairly controversial figure, and he doesn't seem to be tempted by all of this.
You mentioned, and you wrote this very interesting column, a couple of them actually, of why it is that there are political candidates who fail so miserably at relating to regular people. You talk about Bill Clinton being a master of being able to do that, and Richard Nixon at the other extreme. But Mitt Romney and John Kerry, you have this great story about John Kerry trying to give you a jacket, which I want you to tell us about. But you know, you would think that politicians would learn how to do that. You just take a course on small talk, on being passionate about things, on being friendly.
You would expect that, wouldn't you?
Yes, you would.
You know, now people feel very self-conscious because everything is being videotaped. Even if there's no press there, there's a bystander with a cell phone or something. But it's an instinct, and some of them just don't have it. You know, they have other reasons for being in politics. And the story with Kerry was just hilarious. It was election day, I think, the very last day. And we were flying to Boston, and he was going through the plane giving out these little fleece jackets to his press corps. And when he came to my row, he said, "Now, Jill, you may need a larger size." And his aide started cringing all around
imagine.
Him. And he just kept digging the hole deeper. You know, he'd say, "Well, no, you know, you have very broad shoulders. Well, no, I mean, you're just not as small as your seatmate." And it was pretty hilarious because, I mean, first of all, it was bright orange. I knew I'd never wear it anyway. And second of all, it fit. But third of all, it was such a classic Kerry moment. He sometimes was very good with people, but then sometimes he was completely clueless. You know, it was just a real crapshoot which way he was going to go.
And that's also true of Romney, would you say, Jill?
I think that is true of Romney. I think he's even worse at it. He just, you know, the things that he seems to think are funny, like pretending someone pinched his bottom while he's posing with a bunch of waitresses for a picture, or telling people that, like them, he too is unemployed.
Oh.
Yeah, these are just not...
Right.
He's actually in this mode of tweeting about fast food he's eating and things like that, and people are just making relentless fun of him because he's trying so hard to seem like a regular guy. He is worth over $200 million. His houses, he's got several houses, including one in San Diego on the beach that he's planning to double in size or even more so when you add the basement. So, you know, it's pointless, and... You know, President Obama, when he talks about people with money, includes himself and in that calculation. He always talks about people like me who've been successful. Romney actually called himself part of the middle class the other day.
Oh, no.
He said, "What about the rest of us?"
Oh, yeah, that doesn't play very well, does it? And yet,
no, I mean, it's all, and of course, it's all on videotape.
Yeah, and yet Richard Nixon became president, and he couldn't do small talk at all.
Well, that's true, but I think the full extent of how bad he was and how awkward he was didn't come out until later when people wrote books because, you know, there were no trackers with video cameras at his events, and a lot of it was in private conversations. He might do better now. He was a quick study, but you could tell during his debate performances that he was not at ease.
So let's...
A slower tempo then, you know?
Right. Yeah. He was never a real likable guy, but it didn't seem to make too much difference.
No. And that's not necessarily a prerequisite to being president, but you have to be relatable these days. You have
right.
to be able to relate to people.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the new Barack Obama, who appears to be quite tough these days, going to bridges that are falling apart and asking your opponents to fix these bridges now. Where did this guy come from, and why now?
Well, I think this guy has always been there. I think for a long time he had to think about the economy of the nation. He had to think about what would happen if there was a default. You know, he had to hold back and negotiate. And if you recall from the debt negotiations, the one non-negotiable item on his side was that it had to be raised, the debt ceiling had to be raised high enough so that it would get past the election, that there wouldn't be a crisis on the debt until after the 2012 election. And so the point is that now there's no danger of default. And so, you know, if he thinks he can't get anything or if he thinks he needs to be tougher or start from a position further to the left, well, then, you know, there's nothing at stake, really. The status quo will continue. The country's not going to default. So I think that's one reason. And, of course, we are getting into campaign season, so he is seeing that he's having some trouble with the base. So he's trying to energize different groups in the Democratic coalition. You know, he was at the Congressional Black Caucus weekend giving speeches, trying to rev up his, you know, that part of the base. and I see that they're revving up something with the Jewish community. You know, that I'm sure they'll get to Hispanics and everyone else by the time this is all over, because they really need people to be as energized as Republicans.
Mm-hmm. How do you explain these numbers? I usually don't follow them, except that when you look at them and they're so abysmal that you got to wonder what's behind the congressional ratings, which are now something like 13 and 15%. Nobody likes what's going on in Washington. His numbers are going down. Everybody is darned unhappy.
Well, I think that's true, and I think that has to do with the fact of Republicans just taking this very, very, very absolutist stand, which, you know, it's, on the one hand, it's managed to move the country in the direction of looking at the deficit and the debt and its spending habits, but on the other hand, they seem impervious to compromise. So nothing happens. We're in the middle of what, our third potential government shutdown standoff now. Every little thing turns into a confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's funding for the Federal Aviation Administration, whether it's trade treaties that everyone agrees should be passed, and now it's, you know, whether the FEMA will get money to keep going. You know, the argument, it concerns whether that money should be offset by cuts to other things, and which is really rare and which Republicans have not voted for in the past, especially when their states and districts have been affected. So, you know, it's kind of a new ball game, and everything is a potentially a source of gridlock.
We go to phone calls. Oh, I'm sorry, Jill. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I think the numbers reflect the fact that Congress just can't seem to get anything done. And
the debt
agreement they did get punted the whole problem to a super committee of 12 people.
Yeah. Jill Lawrence, our guest, contributing writer for The Daily Beast, writes for The Atlantic Monthly, has covered politics for quite some time and every presidential election with quite a bit of thoroughness since 1988. Our lines are busy, but keep this number in your head and we'll get to you as soon as we can. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, the Milwaukee Brewers are champions of the National League Central Division. It was a great game, wasn't it? And so we are going to talk about it. How often do we talk about baseball? And how often does this happen to the Milwaukee Brewers? Not very often. So even more unusual is my husband and my son are going to be my guests. I wonder if we'll all get along with each other. We will. Michael Bauman is a national columnist for MLB.com who will be covering the Brewers in the playoffs. And Andrew, our son, Andrew Dunn Bauman, we gave him one of those names that will be difficult all his life, is a student at UWM and is an intern for ESPN and is a baseball fanatic. So the two of them, I won't have to say anything. Introduce them, let them roll. Let's go to phone calls now for all things political, and we start with Eugene in Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
I am wondering, what's the economic downturn you've had in this country and also worldwide? If we are seeing or going to see the rise of the far right and the religious far right, and if so, that is going to be scary.
Well, I think we saw that with the Tea Party, which a lot of research has now shown to be pretty much people on the right, very conservative, very religious. And that seems to be fading, actually, because the issues really are different than their issues, because the issues are economic, as you say. So it may be, we'll have to see. I'm going out on a limb here making a prediction, but 2010 may have been the high water mark for those, for that part of the Republican Party.
You quote a pollster in one of your recent pieces saying any candidate running will have to be careful of how conservative they are on the social questions.
Right. I think that was Terry Madonna in Pennsylvania. We were talking about Rick Perry. I had done a long piece about the problems he potentially faces in swing states. And Terry Madonna said that in Pennsylvania, these swing suburbs outside of Philadelphia, these are very, you know, a lot of concentration of population, very important to which way the state goes. There was a 52% level of support in that area for gay marriage. That was higher than any other place in the state by almost 20 points, including the city of Philadelphia. These people are not conservative socially. They are conservative fiscally, and they do decide elections in Pennsylvania. So that was one example of where, you know, someone who gets off too far onto the right fringe or, you know, is too inflammatory in the way they talk about certain issues could be in trouble in that swing state.
Thanks, Eugene, for the call. We go to Jerry in La Crosse next. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah. Hello. Thanks. I would like to have you talk a little bit about how to select a president. I mean, I think I heard on your show, I think, Joy, once that one of the guests said that, you know, you really, what people say during a run for office doesn't mean anything because, you know, they're just saying it to get elected. And I think that's true. And we should worry less about what people are saying to the Hispanics, what they're saying to the Jews, whether they're good debaters. All those things are just really sort of worthless in selecting a president.
Well, what should we do? How do we select one?
I would have a show where you invite a headhunter or someone on a board of directors who's selected a president for, say, General Electric or some large company. How do they select their leadership? I think our president now, who I voted for, I thought he would be wonderful. I thought he would be a leader. He talked like a leader, but he's not. And I looked at his history, at what he has done in the past. He has not been a leader in the past. He's been and so I think we have to look at what people have done in the past and pay no attention to what they say. Just look at their history. People will continue to do what they've always done. That's my belief.
All right. Jill?
I don't mean to take issue with your caller here. I think that what you're objecting to is the style of leadership, you know, the oratory that he made you think during the campaign that he was going to be a very dynamic leader, and it turned out that he was a policy wonk, which was always part of his makeup but was not on display very much during the campaign because that's not the skill that was called for. But you'll find, I think, if you look back, that people do talk about things in their campaigns and then they go on to do them. You know, George Bush talked about the tax cuts. He talked about No Child Left Behind, and then he did them. Bill Clinton talked about various things that he did. And Obama talked a lot about health care and other aspects. Now, all of them get hit up by things that they didn't expect. 9/11 in the case of George Bush, the terrible recession in the case of Obama. But, you know, he said he'd repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and he did it. There's a lot of things you can chalk up, and the things that he hasn't accomplished, you know, the record shows that he's tried to in some cases. So I think you can actually tell what they're going to try to do from their policy agenda. You can't really tell, it's true, if they're going to be able to grab the presidency and use it as the bully pulpit. I'm not sure what anyone could have done in the situation Obama's in, because if he had gotten too confrontational with Republicans too early and just kept giving speeches that were very tough, then who knows what would have happened to the economy if they had been at loggerheads the whole time.
You probably, more than anybody in our audience, have listened to presidential candidates, and you've done so for a number of years. Do you think that their words are important, or is everything so scripted now because they're worried about something that will come back to haunt them that they keep pretty much to script and say essentially the same thing over and over?
You know, that is the sign of a very disciplined candidate. I think that you do get glimpses of who they really are. For instance, Obama, when he appears at Democratic fundraisers, usually is a lot looser than he is when he's giving a speech or when he's giving a press conference. And certainly in these Republican debates, you're getting a pretty good window on how people are, especially Rick Perry and Mitt Romney. So I think, you know, there are ways to gauge who they are and how they'd react. And really, it's a question of character and personality, because you can't tell what a president's going to face when he's in office. You just have to feel comfortable with the way they react during campaign, you know, that you trust them with reacting to whatever happened. But, I mean, this is Rick Perry's big problem at the moment, because he got the 3 a.m. question in the last debate. You know, I think it was something about what if Pakistan had... I can't remember. Something about
right.
nuclear crisis.
If Al-Qaeda got a hold of Pakistan's nuclear weapons or...
Yeah, and he just had nothing to say. So that was disturbing, and he's going to have to dig out of that hole. But, you know, so that's what you're really looking for. Do you trust the person to handle the unexpected?
And thank you very much, Jerry, for the call. We go to Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. What I'd like to highlight today is the fundamental Republican problems in getting anything done. Through some analogies. And in the first one, in the pharmaceutical industry, people are hired to be developing new products so that they can be maintaining the profits of the company. In another example, there are two boats in the middle of a lake and with two people in them, and each boat has a leak and is in peril of sinking. In the boat with the two Democrats, one Democrat tries to, as best he can, fix the leak, and the other Democrat rows like hell for shore because the idea is to rescue the boat and save the people in it and then work on skills of maintaining and restoration of boats when you get to shore. In the Republican boat, the two Republicans spend their time arguing about who's going to pay for restoring the boat, and the boat sinks, but they don't worry about it because they know that if the people in the boat are the right people and decent people, they'll be able to swim to the shore without government interference. Now, the way this relates to life and politics as we see it now is that what goes around comes around. And with the, for example, the flood relief in the East, the issue that they're having now, the Republicans are, as usual, denying, blocking, obstructing, and stalling progress on the matter. And so as a result of this, the situation is lingering, it's languishing, it's worsening, and the Republicans are aggravating the situation by obstructing any solution of the problems. And so ultimately, what you see is what you get.
Jill.
Well, I like your analogies. They're interesting. I think, you know, that one of the problems Republicans are having now is one of the first things that Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader, said right after the 2010 election when he said that his top priority was to make Obama a one-term president. That has kind of cast doubt on the motives. It's kind of documentary evidence that you know, the motives of Republicans might not be pure. Now, maybe some of them are, but this framework of we're going to just deny Obama a second term makes everything they do suspect. And so, you know, and the other thing is they've got this faction in the House that believes they were sent here for one purpose, and that is to stop spending. And they don't care if they get reelected. So that's another problem. You know, I guess in your analogy would be they don't care if the boat sinks. Mm. You know, they are just here with their message. That's how they got elected. I think that they are mistaken. I know the exit polls did not show a mandate for whatever they think they got. It showed unhappiness with what was happening, unhappiness mostly with the economy. And they are, you know, definitely overinterpreting what they were sent to Washington to do. So, I don't know. You think the boat's going to sink? I don't know. It's.
I hope not.
It's just unfortunate, you know, in terms of from a constructive standpoint, that this whole thing is taking place in the context of that remark of making Obama a one-term president.
Thank you, Jim, very much for your call. I always feel like we've been at the best of services when we talk our Sunday service on Monday with Jim. Thank you, Jim. Let's go next to Mark in Eau Claire. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Hi.
My concern is the polarization of both parties, that to get elected, you have to be, it seems like you have to become further and further to the left or to the right to get elected. And then what happens is it just polarizes everything. And if you are someone who looks like you will compromise, you're just looking for good ideas, hey, you're considered weak, and for either party, we're not going to elect you. So that's my concern, getting back to a comment that was made before about gridlock and how you get elected and what happens once you get elected. And I guess I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
I think that's more true for members of the House than for the presidency or the Senate, and that is why you see such polarization in the House. Obama and Hillary Clinton were not, you know, wild-eyed leftists. Obama, in fact, angered a lot of constituent groups along the way. You know, he talked about teacher testing, and that was upsetting to some people in the teachers' union. He did not have an individual mandate in his health plan when he was running for office. You know, maybe that was strategic or tactical. Maybe it was that he just didn't believe in it. But, you know, there were a lot of ways that he was the moderate that he seems to be and the compromiser, and it has hurt his image in office. But the House races are another question altogether, and that's because their districts are so focused on one type of voter. You know, whenever there's districts being redrawn, they become more conservative to help the conservative incumbent or more liberal to help the liberal incumbent. And there's very little opportunity in the House to come up with compromises to work together because the party with control has iron control. And it's not like the Senate where you have to worry about who's going to gum up the works by objecting to something or staging a filibuster or putting a hold on something. So, you know, the Senate, yes, it does tend towards more gridlock, but there's also more compromise. And there are a bunch of groups trying to kind of get at this problem, one of them called No Labels. I see groups on my Twitter feed, Centered Politics, The Moderate Voice, people like that. It's hard to work up passion, though, for moderation. That's one of the problems.
Right. That's true. People like passion, too. The darn thing is, though, that there seems to be this total, not disregard, but neglect of all that people are going through these days. A few people are making a lot of money. A lot of people are really struggling. They don't have jobs, and their pay has gone down, and the pay is concentrated in the hands of those who don't have very much. It's hard to think that there are a lot of people in Washington who really you know, feel the pain that people are going through. They want something done about it, and it seems as though nobody's listening. That's a bad state to be in.
It is a bad state to be in. You know, it's very bad for Obama that you think that he's not listening to them and caring about this, because he does talk about it quite a lot, and he does have this system where his staff picks out some letters every day for him to read each night. You know, I think he said 10 letters. So he does hear firsthand from people. I think, you know, one of the mandates that the Republicans took from their election in 2010 was that the only thing people really cared about was the deficit. And that was the wrong message.
Right.
But that is the message that they're on.
Mm-hmm.
That is what they talk about all the time. And so John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, you know, you don't hear them commiserating about what people in hard times are going through. You hear them mostly talking about protecting the incomes of job creators, quote unquote. And, you know, it's kind of a concern for the jobless once removed. You know, give all the money to the people who create jobs. Let them keep their low tax rates, and they will create jobs. And, I mean, that is one way of looking at the problem. It doesn't seem to be working so far because people aren't hiring. And other people have other interpretations of what's going on. Just no consumer demand, precisely because people don't have jobs, don't have a lot of disposable income or any income at all. So, you know, and Republicans are always in the situation of trying to block, you know, extensions of insurance, of unemployment benefits, because they want to offset it with some cuts elsewhere. It's you know, their image as a party, I think they ought to be more concerned about that. And Democrats ought to be concerned that their message isn't getting out.
Right. Right. I think you're absolutely right. Mark, thanks for the call. Tim and Ladysmith, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Interesting show. A couple of points. One is, when people claim, you know, they voted for this president and they really thought he'd be something that he wasn't, I just really think Americans are incredibly fiscally, socially irresponsible. This president is probably one of the least qualified presidents we've had in recent years. He talks a good game, but he's just wailing over his head in both domestic as well as international politics. his policies have been a dismal failure. Part of the problem is stymieing growth in this country is his refusal to take government bureaucracy off the back of business, and business is crying about that. The other issue about elections, we talk about election reform. We all know that basically it doesn't matter if you put a Republican or Democrat in office, we're going to get more of the same. We need to shorten the entire election campaign cycle. Americans have a responsibility to get educated. You got a almost a two-year process of electing people. It's like a perpetual election cycle. Where's people out? We're fed up with it. This government just is inept, and people need to stop putting their trust in the government. It's just not qualified to do what it's doing.
So who do you? Well, you got to have government, don't you think, Tim?
Yeah, but it's way too big, and we become like the government is our god. We look to the government to solve every little problem, and really we need to shrink government. It is far too involved in too many areas it has no business being involved in, and that's part of our problem.
Jill.
Well, I'm not sure where it's involved that it shouldn't be involved. I mean, we need it for defense. We need it. I mean, education is now sort of central to economic growth and to some extent national security. We need it for the transportation infrastructure. We need it to keep the air clean. You know, we need it for the tax infrastructure. We need it, I think, for health because, you know, that is a responsibility, well, first of all, that states are not fulfilling and that, you know, there are federal programs for the elderly. So we need it for the safety net. Now, maybe we don't need such an extensive safety net, or maybe we could have a better, more efficient safety net that would push more people towards work and independence. But, you know, I think we need it quite a bit. I would certainly agree with that we would need a shorter campaign season. That would be great for everyone.
For you, but in particular, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. Although, you know, you do get a sense of a candidate during a long campaign, and that is one reason that people concluded that Barack Obama had what it took to be president, because he ran a very long and very good campaign. You know, it was a, you know, hundreds of millions of dollar enterprise with lots and lots of employees. So, and I'm not sure what people mean when they say he's in over his head. He had experiences, not necessarily in the federal government, and you know, everybody, in a sense, who comes in there, except for possibly a vice president, is in over their head at the start because there's just no job like it. And I don't, you know, I don't know how you could say that he's in over his head when he got Osama bin Laden and he's taken out the leadership of al-Qaeda, you know, with these drone strikes, you know, that he seems to have made the right call on Libya. You know, there are things that he's tried to do that he hasn't been able to do. There are things that he's done that have taken fire from both sides. The Wall Street regulations, probably our caller here objects to those, but there are some who thought it was a very mild wrist slap to the people who had brought on this great recession. So, you know, that is a conservative theme that Obama is in over his head, and yet a lot of conservatives considered Sarah Palin as a viable candidate and, you know, consider Herman Cain a viable candidate. You know, there are people, or Michelle Bachmann, there are people with less legislative experience than Obama had. So it's very subjective. I guess that's my bottom line.
Jill Lawrence is our guest for All Things Political today. She's a contributing writer for the Daily Beast. She also writes for the Atlantic Monthly, and she's been covering every presidential election since 1988. Our phone number, Tim, thanks for your call. One line is open right now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We do have an email. We'll get to that when we return from this pause. And we welcome you to send your emails, too. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two, we just couldn't pass it up. We'll be talking about the Milwaukee Brewers. They clinched the National League Central Division title on Friday, one whale of a game. And our guests will be Michael Bauman, national columnist for MLB.com, and Andrew Dunbauman, a student at UWM, ESPN Milwaukee intern, and a former play-by-play announcer for WRST. One's my husband and one's my son. We just haven't done this before. We'll have a good time, and we'll welcome your phone calls, all of you baseball fans. All right, let's go back to I wanted to do an email next. An email from Bob in Waukesha. Hi, he says, an increasingly likely scenario as a result of the 2012 election seems to be the possibility of a Republican House or Republican Senate, yet Obama wins re-election. What does that say about both the U.S. electorate and long-term prospects for politics in this country? Jill?
Wow, that would be complicated.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if there is a Republican Senate, it will be because of individual candidates and their appeal. And what it says about the electorate is they're thinking big picture and they don't want much to happen, or they're not thinking big picture. They're looking specifically at their state and the relative appeal of the candidates running in their state, maybe local issues, local economic issues or social issues if it's a conservative state. So there are all kinds of ways to look at this. I'm not sure what President Obama would make of that situation in terms of a mandate or not. Would he feel he needs to compromise with Republicans in the Senate? One thing that we haven't actually discussed is that there probably would be enough Democrats to stage a filibuster.
Mm.
So there would be two kind of fail-safes. There would be, for Democrats, there would be a presidential veto, and there would be a Democratic filibuster. So in that sense, you might not see a very different situation than there is now.
We go to Kathy in Waupaca. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm going to play that card that they always accuse liberals of playing. It seems to me Republicans really, really didn't care much about deficits before this election, and we have engaged in two wars without a raise of taxes, and that has never happened before in United States history. And it seems to me that they only got really concerned about the deficit once a black man got in the White House. And it seems to me so many tea partiers, I got to use the right term, you see a very, very small handful of black tea partiers, very small. It seems a largely racist phenomenon. And I'd just like your comments on that.
Thanks, Kathy.
I guess I would disagree mostly because I remember covering the Clinton administration, and the Republicans hated the Clintons so much. They accused them of murder in Arkansas. They accused them of killing Vince Foster, their good friend who killed himself. I mean, there was just such poison in the air and in the media. It was really awful. It sort of culminated in the impeachment trial. So race had nothing to do with it in that respect. I think that that more so on the Republican side than on the Democratic side, there's this idea that if you disagree, if you have opposite ideas, it's evil, or it's so desperately wrong for the country that we're going to be, you know, bound for rack and ruin. And they're very absolutist in the stands they take. And it is true. I wrote a piece for Politics Daily when I worked there called Seven Things Republicans Were For Before They Were Against. And it's, you know, the hypocrisy was just beyond, it was overwhelming. And some of it was politically motivated. A lot of changes in view on immigration led by John McCain as they tried to adapt to the Tea Party environment. Same with climate change. But the spending and Medicare, although I have to say the Democrats also can be hypocritical on that. You know, whichever party is proposing cuts is the party that gets hit on it, depending on the election. So, yes, there's been a lot of reversals. And it wasn't just the wars that were financed without a tax offset. It was the Medicare prescription drug program. So there were all kinds of things that went wrong in terms of spending. And they do renounce Bush now, the Republicans. And John McCain actually won the nomination in 2008 and campaigned in 2008 saying Republicans had really messed up. That doesn't change the fact that they gave Bush everything he wanted without offsetting it. So So, you know, it seems to be that the Republicans make the mess. The Democrats come in, try to clean it up. The Republicans decide that they don't want to help.
Well, Kathy, thanks for the call. Let's spend a little more time on this race issue. It was just appalling to me, and it wasn't all that long ago, that this birth certificate question was front and center over and over and over and over. I found it absolutely disgusting. And I really thought that there was an element of race in that conversation. Do you think that we have reached a point where race is not an issue that's of much importance to many Americans, that they look at the president and see him completely as the president and don't take the element of race into regard?
I think that's true of a lot of people, most people, obviously, because he won, and he has very high personal approval ratings, favorability ratings, as opposed to job approval, which is sinking. I do think some people are finding it hard to make the transition to the multicultural society, and he's a transitional figure in that respect. But I think that a lot of mainstream Republicans were getting very nervous about all the birther stuff because they felt, and I think correctly so, that it was going to reflect very badly on them. And again, I go back to these Southeast Pennsylvania suburbanites, that they don't like that. You know, that's not their thing. They don't like intolerance. They don't like, you know, extremism. And, you know, this is just not a way to broaden the party base. And so, and they knew, you know, if you look at polls, it's only a very, very narrow slice that was involved in that, maybe 10%. So I think that people have gotten over that whole was he born here thing. I really do, and most of them anyway, enough so that Obama could win the next election, and if he doesn't, I don't think it'll have anything to do with that.
Hmm. Kathy, thanks for the call. Stephanie in Madison, hi.
Hi there. I am so glad that Kathy came in front of me because I have calmed down. One of the things that I have just felt so thoroughly about, and I think probably I'm just reflecting a lot of people in increasing partisanship because of things have become so polarized. The resentment about people who try to scream about the very problem that they caused, basically. I mean, Obama inherited such a mess when he took office. I mean, he's not perfect. You know, he's a darn smart guy. And, you know, what I'm really hoping for, I'm beginning to maybe see some trends. I think the American people are beginning to see through all these games as they play out. People have complained about the Democrats, you know, not being aggressive enough. And it's just, you know, we're going to not have anything but a two-party system. I wish we could, you know, I wonder what it would be like if we had, like, a coalition government or a parliamentary system. But, hey, that's, you know, that's a pipe dream. I heard about Lamar Alexander resigning his leadership post because he wants to be able to be freer to negotiate with other people in Congress. And I guess all I can do is hope and pray that we somehow work through this horrible, I mean, this is so painful. It really, really is. And I used to be a pretty, you know, be able to listen to all sides, and it's become harder and harder for me to do that without reacting to anger. And I guess maybe it's the hypocrisy. You know, oh, government's too big, and all the games that are played. You know, yeah, government's too big, except when they want to tell you how to live your personal lives.
All right, let's get a response. Jill.
Well, I was very interested in Lamar Alexander's move also. I mean, the cynical interpretation is he was going to try to move up, and he knew he couldn't win because he's the number three Republican in the Senate, and the number two spot is opening up. But before this whole era, he was a moderate, and he did believe in compromise, and, you know, he was governor, he was the head of a university. Education is very important to him. So that was an encouraging sign. It's just kind of very sad that you have to resign from leadership in order to play that role. You know, leaders used to play those roles of negotiating. And so, you know, on the one hand, yes, that's encouraging. Now, there's something else going on in the Republican presidential race and also in the Massachusetts Senate race, where differences are getting defined. You know, the argument that Rick Perry uses in the race against Mitt Romney is that we don't need Obama light, we need a big contrast to Obama.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a very polarizing election. In Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren is running, very populist, very good at explaining exactly what's happened to society, you know, in terms of income inequality and people on hard times, while the top, you know, 1% or 0.1% do exceedingly well, and how bad this is, not just for people, but for society and the economy. And so, you know, that's turning into a race where I think she's going to set the pace and the tone for the messages of many other Democrats, and including President Obama.
She's
so
fairly
this could be a polarizing election. I expect it to be a really polarizing election, but maybe the result will be more people like Lamar Alexander. We can just hope.
Mm-hmm. And whether or not you like her policies, you have to admire somebody like Warren for just being able to relate to what we were talking about earlier, people who are hurting, and have her vision of how that would change. I mean, she's got that caring thing down. She seems to really care, and I think that that translates into people thinking of her. She's interested in us. She's interested in some solutions here.
She did make a very good impression. I was up in Massachusetts when she announced.
Oh, were you?
A very good impression on people who saw her on the news talking about this.
You mm-hmm.
know, people who weren't necessarily very strong Democrats or Republicans. People in the middle. There's the majority of voters in Massachusetts are unaffiliated with a party. So, you know, she's definitely striking a chord. Now, you know, a lot of people compare this age to the Gilded Age, but it took a long time for the people who were hurting to make their voices heard politically, and for the people who were doing incredibly well to realize that this was not a healthy situation and could come back to bite them, too. I'm not sure we're at that point yet. I'm not sure we'll even be there at the 2012 election. But that seems to be where we're headed, towards some kind of mid-course
mm-hmm.
correction, if voters realize what's been going on.
Stephanie, thanks for the call. Nancy in Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I have two issues. One of them is very delicate. Obama is a partly black person, and he has such wonderful, admirable qualities. But I'm sure that for a large part of his life, he has heard this phrase, uppity black. And I think that phrase is buried deep in his psyche, and that is partly to account for his very conciliatory attitude toward the Republicans and his need to almost constantly appease them. And that topic I haven't ever heard discussed, and I'd like to have it discussed. But my other issue is even more important, and that is that I think we have to have either a 5- or 6-year one-term presidency. I just cannot stand any longer this constant election cycle. And I very much resent the fact that during the last 2 years of anybody's presidency, that person is out campaigning for his colleagues and to reelect himself. And therefore, there's much less energy and time spent in Washington devoted to the topics at hand. And that would be entirely eliminated if there was just a one-term presidency.
All right, let's get a response. We're getting short on time.
I think a 6-year presidency is a great idea. I really do. I mean, it's the same as a Senate term, and I just think it'd be, if you can't accomplish what you need to in 6 years, it's somebody else's turn. And I think you would have a year of that spent campaigning for people of the same, you know, and at the end of that, and you would have the midterms, of course, you know, in year two and in year four, you'd still have some of the politics, but it wouldn't be at all at the level that we see now. So I think that's a great idea. As far as the uppity black thing, I think the more important stereotype that he's been conscious of is the angry black man, and, you know, his personality is not angry.
No, no.
And so, you know, he also has been very conscious of trying not to appear angry. So, and his whole life, you know, starting from when he was a community organizer, has been to find the common ground. That's what the job is, to kind of stay in the background, make people realize that they've reached consensus by manipulating the conversation, you know, directing the conversation, pointing out where there are common, where they share aspirations and share problems. And so, you know, that is a good model for a community organizer. It has not turned out to be a good model for a president. And, I mean, it's a good model for a legislator also. You know, he accomplished a lot when he was in the Illinois Senate, and considering how short he was in the U.S. Senate also. But it's not what he needs to do as president. So, you know, I think partly he's been trying to avoid the angry black man stereotype. Partly he's been just being himself. And partly I think he's been trying to be very gingerly stepping around economic minefields like a default on the debt. So there are a lot of reasons for this, what you would call appeasement, and I guess I would call it, you know, just kind of trying to step lightly while you make your way towards your goals, even if you have to take two steps back in the process.
Well, Jill, we're out of time. Thank you so much. We had a great time with you. I hope you'll return.
Well, thank you. I'd love to.
Good. All right. It's a date then. Thanks.
<Okay. laughs>
Jill Lawrence, contributing writer for the Daily Beast. You can tell she knows her politics. She also writes for the Atlantic Monthly. She's an award-winning analyst, columnist, and commentary writer who's covered every presidential election since 1988. She also writes for, she used to be at the Associated Press, national political writer, and has written for the Boston Globe, Atlantic Constitution, Washington Post, Humanities, and other publications. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for doing on-air production. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this interesting hour. And thanks for all of your always astute comments. We have news coming up, and we'll return and have a great hour talking about baseball. So get your calls ready, and we'll do something slightly out of the ordinary. But so is this win, right? So that's coming up in just a little while. Thanks for listening to this hour.